Until natural capital is converted into a commodity denominated in dollars, it is invisible to our economic statistics and balance sheets. It is hard to even articulate the value of nature otherwise. Hence the profusion of environmentalist arguments based on cost-benefit considerations. Why should we save the rainforest? Because of all the medicines that might be produced from the undiscovered plant species there. Because of the economic value of their contribution as a carbon sink. The economic value of their pollinating species. In essence, these arguments try to persuade us to protect the environment because the long-term cost to the economy of environmental destruction far exceeds the economic cost of preservation. Well-meaning as they are, such arguments actually exacerbate the root problem, which is the basic Benthamite assumption that goodness can be quantified, that the way to make life better is to maximize financial returns, and even more deeply, that nature can be made ours, and yet more deeply, the illusion of our separateness. Such arguments grant the disastrous premise that nature is indeed a thing, best disposed of according to the financial consequences. Cost-benefit arguments for environmental protection have the further disadvantage that they are usually ineffective even as a short-term tactic. I am inspired in this regard by Gandhi's exhortation to appeal to their reason and conscience, and by Edwin O. Wilson's invocation of a universal biophilia, a love of living beings, innate to each one of us, however deeply buried. In the long run, and probably even in the short run, it may be more effective to appeal to people's sense of beauty and their desire to do the right thing. Let's save the environment because otherwise it will cost too much, is an appeal to a baser instinct. It disrespects its audience by assuming that greed is their strongest motivation. It is especially counterproductive when facing people who stand to gain financially from consuming natural capital. It is also on some level dishonest. I do not know any environmentalist motivated by the long-term economic savings of environmental protection. Let us appeal instead to what is highest in other people, their sense of rightness, beauty, and justice, their desire to be a good person, their longing to enact their innate love for our beautiful planet. The greed behind the plundering of the planet and the insecurity and anxiety behind the greed is, after all, a product of our money system, as well as an inevitable effect of our separation from self, spirit, nature, and each other. It is not our true essence. The conversion of all forms of wealth into money violates our sense of beauty, rightness, and purpose. It has made the world uglier. In the realm of art, epithets like commercial art or a sellout are not compliments. Nor would most people maintain that a lumberyard is more beautiful than the forest, or that the beauty of a well-constructed highway exceeds that of the landscapes destroyed by quarries, mines, and so forth that provided its raw materials. On a personal level, how often do issues of practicality, which more often than not involve money, seem to interfere with our longing to live a beautiful life? Usually, rational economic interests seem to directly contradict Joseph Campbell's urging, follow your bliss. I cannot count the number of times when I didn't do something in the most beautiful way because, quote, I could not afford to. Just as the conversion of the world to money makes less of the world, so does a conversion of life to money, time is money, make less of life. Adam Smith's economic man, making choices according to his rational self-interest, affirms the presumption that the value of all things can be tabulated in terms of money. All things admit of a value, a quantity, a measure. Here is a translation and reduction of the immeasurability of the wild into the numbers of human abstraction, and thus the wild nature is brought under control. Here is another parallel with the program of science which seeks, through its equations, to reduce nature to human terms. The disregard that modern human economies and the science of economics have for the environment is inseparable from our fundamental understanding of self and world. As Herman Daly says, the materialistic, mechanistic worldview implies that the natural world is just a pile of instrumental, accidental stuff to be used up on the arbitrary projects of one's purposeless species. Close quote. If there is no real purpose beyond personal survival, comfort, and pleasure, if the order and beauty of nature is mere accident, and life a seething scum on an insignificant ball of rock hurtling through space, and all existence a sound and fury signifying nothing, then what does it matter, really, the fate of this earth? At this point, it is customary to trot out God as an imposer of meaning, purpose, and sacredness onto our world of dead matter. Such a response, unfortunately, leaves matter no less dead, life no less mundane, and beauty no less arbitrary. When God is separate from creation and spirit is separate from matter, we naturally construe teachings such as "be fruitful and multiply" as divine license to pillage and wreck and converting natural wealth into personal financial wealth. Too often the theistic treatment of our planet is no less destructive than the atheistic, and even more. A non-dualistic religion sees things differently. Wendell Berry, arguing from Scripture, puts it eloquently, quote, "Creation is not in any sense independent of the Creator, the result of a primal creative act long over and done with, but is the continuous, constant participation of all creatures in the being of God," close quote. Instead of granting us divine license to plunder creation, non-dualistic religion would see the destruction of nature as, to quote Berry, "a most horrid blasphemy. It is flinging God's gifts into his face as if they were of no worth beyond that assigned to them by our destruction of them," close quote. By converting natural capital into financial capital, we are assigning a monetary value to the work of God, excusable perhaps if matter is separate, mundane, unspiritual, but not if nature is the sacred, ongoing expression of divine creativity. In Psalms 24:1 it is written, quote, "The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein," close quote. Seen in this light, the conversion of the earth into assets, resources, and property that started with agriculture is nothing more than an attempted robbery, a sacrilege of the highest order. Only the illusion of our separateness gives us the temerity. Sadly, because our separateness is indeed only an illusion, we cannot escape the damaged and diminished world that our despoilation has rendered. We can, however, start to reverse the uglification of the world by using our creative gifts, including our technology, toward the divine purpose for which those gifts are meant, to create beauty. If the things of the world are put here for our use, as some interpret the Bible to say, what other use could it be besides as a participation in and an extension of God's ongoing work of creation? A fallen branch can be made a flute. Every time we cut down a tree or dig a new quarry, the question we should ask ourselves is, does this augment the divinity of creation by making it more beautiful, or does it detract from the divinity of creation by making it more ugly? And the answer must apply to the whole of creation, not just a part of it, not just to the sleek new automobile, but to the mine pits, polluted air, and ravaged landscapes that go hand in hand with present industrial processes. What shall we make of this beautiful world into which we have been born? And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Spiritual capital. It's not only the physical and cultural wild that has been converted and sold off as property. We have done the same to the wild within ourselves, our imagination, creativity, attention span, playfulness, and spontaneity. I call these things spiritual capital because they are indeed productive assets, generators of wealth. In describing their co-optation and conversion into financial capital, I describe how the ascent of humanity has in fact eroded our humanity, made us lesser beings. It is a process that has been going on for some time, at least since the origin of agriculture. Interestingly, there are allusions to this degeneration of human capacity in several ancient spiritual traditions, particularly Taoism. While perhaps better understood as metaphors for the submerged capacities of childhood, Taoism rebounds with references to ancient humans who possessed wisdom and abilities far exceeding those of people today. Similar references exist in ancient stories of the Golden Age, in Greek and nearly every other mythology. In discussing social capital, I talked of technology as a means by which activities that people once did for themselves are turned over to paid specialists. We pay others to do for us what we once did for ourselves. Perhaps the most profound aspect of this shift is in a realm that few of us have ever considered as a form of capital, the capacity to imagine and play. I was fortunate enough to experience childhood just before the age of video games, Nintendo, Game Boy, and the like, and was protected by idealistic parents from at least some of the damage of television. I remember spending hours in my room with my stuffed animals, rock collection, and other toys, weaving elaborate stories about them. To each, I would assign a personality. Each would become a character in an imaginary world existing either solely in my own head or among siblings and playmates. Today, this creative function of imagining worlds and the characters in them has been taken over by faraway adults in television studios and software development companies who provide children with the ready-made worlds and personalities of TV shows and video games. A capacity of the human mind has been stripped from the individual for profit's sake. And what shoddy substitutes these commercially motivated worlds are for the spontaneous creations of the child's mind. Most of them are worlds of dichotomous good and evil where problems are solved by violence, that are devoid of nuance and detail, and that are disconnected from the rest of the world. Worse yet, they are unlike the mind of a child, finite, limited by the medium of the story. They therefore constrain the freedom of the child's mind to develop and play out various elements of the unconscious. If childhood play is practice for life, then our television raises children to be passive consumers of it. As for video games, they condition us to the mindless acquisition of meaningless rewards, points, to the destruction of generic enemies, and to accepting choices defined by remote others, the programmers of our lives. The kind of adult that results from a childhood bereft of the opportunity for spontaneous, self-directed world-making is someone who will continue to be vulnerable to stories created by others. Not only will he always be in the market for entertainment, but he will be easily manipulable by politicians and advertisers seeking to profit from the acceptance of a certain story, for they will have had no practice in creating a world for themselves. They will be content with meaningless choices contained in a box. They will be passive, determined by the forces around them, much as Newtonian massive bodies move according to the deterministic forces of physics. The economics implicit in our Newtonian worldview have conspired to create human beings whose lack of autonomy and free will confirms the mechanistic conception of dead matter moved by impersonal forces. Our cosmology has been projected onto ourselves. Meaningless choices contained in a box. Can you think of a more apt description of a video game or television? When we speak of children playing with their video games, These are not so much the object of play as they are substitutes for play. And they are merely one small aspect of the disappearance of play from our culture. Play is properly a creative activity. Give a child some blocks, and they become trucks, a city, a forest, a zoo. Put a few children together, and they create worlds of the imagination that incorporate whatever materials are available, both physical and cultural. The play worlds that children create, that together constitute the kingdom of childhood, are practiced for the creative work of the empowered adult, fashioning a good life and contributing to a beautiful world. We are meant to be creative beings, not just to live out the lives that are handed to us. Joseph Chilton Pierce has written, quote, "As a child, reality is whatever one makes of it," close quote. This is potentially true for adults as well, but unlikely if we have never experienced it as children. Unfortunately, the types of toys and activities we provide our children give them little liberty to construct their own kingdoms. Childhood has become a process of breaking the human spirit so that we are indeed content to live the lives that are offered us by the modern economy, or, if not content, unable to imagine anything else, or if able to imagine, disbelieving of our ability to create a different life. Modern life, therefore, leaves us numb, defeated, or hopeless. How has this happened? First, in the last 50 years, the number and variety of toys available to children has proliferated into piles and piles of plastic junk, making it less necessary for them to apply their imagination and creativity to turn ordinary things of the world into toys. Joseph Chilton Pierce observes, "When today's toddler sees her mother making cookies and wants to take part, she need not resort to jar top, stick, and mud like some primitive. She probably has a complete miniature kitchen, scale model perfect with battery-operated appliances." Close quote. Imagination is less necessary. Even worse, today's toys are not passive objects of play that can only come to life in the child's mind. They are animated by electronics. The toy takes charge, and the child assumes a passive role. In most video games, a child does not create the story, but instead moves through a story that has been created for her. Ah, how like modern adult life. If there is room for exploration, as there is in the Pokemon Game Boy, it is still, unlike the real world, finite and programmed. The world is finite, and its limits have been set by someone else. The only mysteries are those that have been fabricated and doled out. I remember as a boy spending hours and hours with my globe, tracing the mountain ranges with my finger, connecting the oceans, making up stories about the different countries, comparing sizes and latitudes. Today's toy globes come complete with computer chips and voice recordings that turn the child into a passive absorber of information. Advertising and packaging for the profusion of computer-enabled devices on the market today trumpet them as educational, as if education were the acquisition of facts. It would seem that for children today, a toy cannot be fun if it doesn't do anything. A toy that just sits there and depends on the child to do something to it is boring. But what has actually happened is that the child's imagination has withered. Children who never had toys that do the play for them are rarely bored. Boredom is actually a kind of withdrawal symptom from the addiction into the ever-intensifying sensual stimulation provided by today's electronic toys, games, and media. The TV show is over. I'm bored. Play some Game Boy. I'm sick of that now. I'm bored. Eat some cookies. I'm full now. I'm bored. Moving from one stimulus to another, the mind develops a higher and higher tolerance to stimulation, and so the dosage must increase. Video games that are even more exciting. Television that is even faster paced, more dramatic. Thus, movies and television programming have, over the last few decades, become increasingly fast-paced, the editing faster, the scenes shorter, the special effects more dramatic. Old movies are kind of boring, aren't they? Boredom is the beginning of the mind's healing process. Like any withdrawal symptom, it is painful, but very soon latent, undeveloped abilities of the human mind start to manifest. Without diverging into a long discussion of the benefits of meditation, silence, and solitude in nature, suffice it to say that children and adults alike benefit from situations that provide the raw materials of creativity and models of creativity, but leave the process of creativity up to the individual. This is also how people learn. The ability to learn constitutes yet another form of spiritual capital that has become grist for the money machine. Boredom is a defining characteristic of modern society for another reason. It represents a hunger for authentic experience. The consumer economy takes advantage of this hunger by selling us artificial experiences of greater and greater variety and intensity. Television and video games are attractive because they temporarily assuage our hunger for experience. Yet at the same time, they are a primary contributor to the separation from reality. Because they are more lurid, more dramatic, and louder than real life becomes boring in comparison. The child becomes so adapted to the extreme stimuli of electronic entertainment that he or she loses sensitivity to more subtle sensations. Also, because the barrage of stimuli in electronic entertainment is so rapid, the child's attention span shrinks to the point where he is incapable of patient, sustained observation. In order to command viewer attention, programmers put a technical event, a zoom, frame shift, new object, into television content every few seconds, engaging the neurological orientation response, also called the startle effect. It is subject to habituation and thus requires increasing intensity over time. Effects more violent, louder, more dramatic, more shocking. No wonder reality is so boring. Compare today's bored, jaded teenager with the piraha described in Chapter 2, who are enthralled watching a boat slowly appear from afar and disappear over the horizon. Today's commercial entertainment embodies the sell-off of our very wonderment at the slow, subtle processes of nature. What is a chick breaking out of a shell compared to cartoon dramas in which the fate of the universe is at stake every half hour? I will never forget a trip I took with my wife and children to the aquarium in Baltimore, Maryland. The place thronged with parents dragging their hyperactive children from one exhibit to another. But most of the children simply weren't interested in looking at the fish. They'd look for a few seconds, then run off, pulling their parents' clothing. Even the sharks failed to hold their attention for very long. Then at one tank, I heard a chorus of voices, children's and adults, saying something about Finding Nemo. Here, finally, was a spark of interest from the children. But it came from a movie. Apparently, one of the fish was identical to a character in a popular children's movie that takes place in a coral reef. The fish in this story were rendered in lifelike 3D animation, and you can bet that the events of that movie were far more exciting, far more stimulating than anything you could see in a fish tank. No wonder the children were bored. Reality is boring. My aquarium experience illustrates a profound phenomenon, the conversion of experience, that is life, into a consumer product. This is the ultimate conversion of spiritual to financial capital, because it means that being in self, the experience of living, costs money. Paid specialists, usually strangers working for enormous organizations, create the life we experience. Of course, it has not yet come entirely to that extreme. But consider, whereas once children would go out into the forest, lake, and field to experience nature, now the experience is packaged and sold to them in the form of an aquarium or nature TV program. By this process, nature is transformed from part of life into a spectacle, even as we rely on others to provide our experiences. In yet another realm of life, we have become consumers. The conversion of life into something that is consumed means that we pass through it instead of creating it for ourselves, which increasingly amount to little more than to go somewhere and look at whatever is provided and listen to whatever is said. Or we put them through the motions of some prescribed, programmed sequences of actions in imitation of the creative process, converting learning into the following of instructions. A couple of years ago, I was a driver for a school field trip to a llama farm. The children were not allowed to touch the animals, their feed, or anything else. All they did was look at the llamas and listen to the employee tell them information. None of them asked any questions, for they were not interested. In fact, it took quite an effort on the part of the teachers to keep order and restrain the children's natural curiosity and desire to explore. They might as well have been watching a program about llamas on television, though I suppose they at least got to smell them. Our town has a children's parade every year, but the children are not in charge of the parade. They merely walk through it, carrying cardboard animals on poles or dressed in costumes created by someone else. I have witnessed crafts that children are trotted through at Sunday school and daycare, which consist of children doing as they are told, step by step, sometimes without even understanding what they are doing, and rarely taking any pride in their finished work. Indeed, it would be too messy, too chaotic, to let the children loose with the raw materials of creativity. Of course, creativity must be constrained to a controlled area and result in a predetermined product that is not creativity at all. It is labor. No wonder the children are so lackadaisical, so unmotivated. They are preparing for an adulthood of following instructions. They are preparing for an adulthood of work, of labor, of being functionaries of the machine. Your creativity will be constrained to a controlled area and result in a predetermined product. Is that your job description, too? One of the most pernicious manifestations of the control and therefore elimination of play has come through organized sports, which started with Little League and extend today into all sports and all age groups. The sandlot, the playground, the neighborhood, and the vacant lot. Where children were once free to hammer out their own rules, choose their own teams, and resolve their own disputes, have been replaced by yet another supervised realm, where play means going through a prescribed set of motions and where the social interaction is mediated and guided by authority. In a way that children do not play the game at all. The game plays the children, who are just accessories. Placeholders fulfilling functions determined by rules created and enforced by adults. Here, play has lost its essential creative nature. I do not know what to call it, but it really is not play anymore at all. It is, however, an excellent conditioning method for producing people who look to authority for instructions on how to play the game. Have you ever felt like you are still one of these placeholders fulfilling functions determined and enforced by some unchallengeable authority? Have you? Then, of course, there is school, which plays a crucial role in the loss of all forms of capital, social, cultural, and spiritual. Here again, children progress through a more or less preset sequence of steps, the curriculum. Here again, children progress through a more or less preset sequence of steps, the curriculum. Their natural desire to explore and create confined to specified times, places, and subjects. They read about the world without experiencing it, reinforcing the notion that knowledge comes from the absorption of information, facts, and data provided by authority, and belittling all the while the very idea that they are competent to really learn for themselves through first-hand observation. The restrictions we place on children arise out of two related concerns, safety and practicality, both of which boil down to some version of control. It is not safe to let your children roam the neighborhood or the forest, as it is to keep them at home. Prefabricated programmed experiences are safer than real experiences in the world, which is beyond the human realm of predictability and control. Similarly, the education we foist upon our children so that they can learn the skills and gain the credentials necessary for a secure position as a paid specialist also attempts to avoid the inherent uncertainty of life. It makes nature provide instead of trusting nature to provide. It is the old distinction between the agriculturalist working to coax food from the land and the hunter-gatherer accepting nature's gifts. In this case, trusting nature refers to trusting that the natural fecundity of the child as a creative being will result in survival and even abundance. But there is more, because creativity is risky, as is unfettered exploration of the world. It is safer to keep Junior at home. But why has safety and security seemingly become our society's highest priority? Just as homeland security can and is being used to justify any repressive measure, so also can child safety justify any limitation on children's freedom to create, explore, and direct their own lives. Really, the emphasis on safety can be seen as a manifestation of our survival anxiety and the assumption that the purpose of life is to survive. From this assumption springs our entire preoccupation with safety, as well as the entire technological program to control reality. How do we keep our children safe? By confining them to a controlled environment where every possible danger has been eliminated. But this essentially takes away the possibility of real experiences, those that haven't been set up and planned out for them. An experience that is programmed, laid out, all its parameters known by another, is somehow phony, like a public relations pseudo-event. It would seem that we are bent on eliminating risk from life, and particularly from childhood. What is risk? It comes from the unknown. Testing the unknown boundaries of our world, which are by definition unknown until we explore them, is inherently a risky activity. Since this is how we learn who we are in relation to the world, the regime of safety, confinement, and supervision in effect prevents children from discovering who they are. It keeps them, that is, from self-realization. Our controlling of children reflects in two ways a technological program to control nature. First, it implements upon our children the program of security through control, which stems from the survival anxiety implicit in our scientific paradigms and underlying our social structures. Second and more striking is this: our children are nature. They represent the very thing we are trying to bring under control. Their spontaneity, creativity, and playfulness, their unruly nature, is the wild we seek to conquer or, to use less inflammatory language, that we seek to mold into the responsible, mature, domesticated adult, someone whose behavior rarely sacrifices the rational self-interest of safety, comfort, and security, embodied to a large degree in money, for the creative risks of the unknown. In precise parallel, we use science to subordinate the unknown universe to human understanding, and we use technology to domesticate the world. The motivations for doing so are identical to those we try to foster in the mature adult: safety, security, and predictability. The subjection of children to a safe, controlled, programmed semblance of life does not end with high school graduation. By the time we reach adulthood, we have become so conditioned to be consumers of a life prepared for us by anonymous others, and so helpless and fearful of creating our own, that we remain forever dependent on fabricated experiences. Another word for experiences fabricated by others is entertainment. In the absence of these, having lost or never developed the capacity for autonomous creativity, we experience a discomfort we call boredom. In my earlier discussion of anxiety theory, I related boredom to Stephen Buhner's interior wound of separation from nature, a hole in the heart so painful that we constantly crave distraction, entertainment, something to take us away from the pain. At the same time, we try to fill in the hole by acquiring more and more possessions, whether tangible or intangible, a futile attempt to fill up the void inside by adding more to the outside. In the context of the loss of spiritual capital, This hole in the heart is nothing less than life itself, our own life, the life we could create for ourselves, but that has been sold off to the demands of technological society. The globe of my childhood was already a step away from real life, the open-ended infinite that is nature, the real world. Already, what I was exploring was a manufactured representation of the world. At least, though, my experience within the confines of that representation was unprogrammed. Through my imaginings, I still played with that globe. It did not play me, turn me into its operator, the button pusher that moves the game from start to finish. Like a child moving through his lessons at school, making his way through the prescribed body of information that constitutes a, quote, education. Like a bunch of confused six-year-olds trying to follow the instructions of their T-ball coach. So do we move through modern life. We go through the steps of a life prepared for us by others, a life that is not our own. As a final step in the conversion of the whole world into money, we are selling off our very lives. What is important here is not so much money, but control. The destruction of the human spirit, accomplished mostly during childhood and maintained to the grave, is another aspect of the taming of the wild, the conquest of nature, the fulfillment of the technological and scientific program at the level of the individual life. Life, in other words, has been brought under control, or so we would persuade ourselves. Why else the emphasis on safety, security, and practicality? As observed, these boil down to an emphasis on survival, which in our specialized society is a function of money. Again, we are selling off our very lives, purchasing experiences instead of creating them, being run by our machines, our schedules, our clocks, and our calendars. Time is money. There are other aspects to the conversion of spiritual capital into money, the diminishment of the human spirit for the sake of profit. Each human being is born as a magnificent, creative, spontaneous spirit, an enormous spiritual being capable of incredible feats of learning. To reduce that spirit to something willing to occupy one of the narrow, meaningless roles in society as we know it, to make that spirit accept the limitation of life today's world offers, and upon which our economy depends, is an enormous enterprise and a shameful crime! We do not really understand what is happening when, as children and teenagers, vast swaths of our spirit are sold off to the demands of the monetized world. We know only that we have been robbed! Occasionally we meet someone who, by some accident of fate, has survived with a full complement of human abilities intact, and we are amazed! We then label that person a genius and dismiss her almost as something not human, and certainly a being in a different category from ourselves. Instead, I urge you to see such people as an indication of your own potential and a promise of a future in which each person's unique brilliance contributes to the co-creation of a beautiful world. For while such potential can be suppressed, even indefinitely, its spark can never go out. It is in you. And in me, how we may get it back will be the subject of much of the latter half of this book.
Time, money, and the good. Social, cultural, natural, and spiritual capital are tightly intertwined. When we privatize cultural capital, such as songs and images, we also destroy the social capital of the human relationships that create them and erode the spiritual capital of individual creative capacity. Moreover, as music and images originate in nature's sounds, vibrational ratios, and electromagnetic spectra, they may be considered natural capital as well. To these four forms of non-money capital could be added many others. Aesthetic capital, for instance, would consist of the unspoiled views, natural landscapes, and unbroken quiet that has nearly disappeared from most of the country. We rarely assign a financial value to such pleasures as a sky full of stars, or see it as a robbery when the lights of civilization blot out all but 30 or 40 of the brightest. Airlines do not understand what they are taking from the public when their jet trails mar every sky from here to Los Angeles. power companies don't appreciate the tragedy of power lines across nearly every panorama. Most children these days have never experienced the stillness of nature. The beeps of construction vehicles backing up and the roar of motors are audible in every park and forest standing in my own corner of suburbia. Add to all this the general uglification of the landscape that accompanies superhighways, industrial facilities, superstores, and strip malls, and we have lost a form of wealth so basic that we hardly ever realize it is missing. Oh, yes, we do, Charles. Increasingly, there is no longer anywhere to escape the separate human realm that we have created. Paradoxically, even as it drives the conversion of beauty into ugliness, money is increasingly required to purchase beauty. A corner of the world insulated from the ugliness without. Houses with a beautiful view command a premium on the real estate market. We pay top dollars for vacation getaways to remote locations. Unique handcrafted items are more expensive than generic mass-produced ones. Aesthetic wealth, once free to all, is increasingly the exclusive province of the rich. Down the street, the bulldozers crush shrubs and trees to put up a new super center. Over the hill, a new highway roars. Pavement, squares, and noise proliferate around me. Maybe when I get rich, I can buy a house out in the country, away from it all. A related form of wealth is a kind of mental silence, whose commoditized form is called mind space. Our attention is for sale to advertisers and anybody else with a product or idea to sell. The result is a cluttering of the mental environment with an unremitting stream of commercial messages on billboards, on buses, on invoices, before movies, at sports events. When I was a child, I don't remember seeing corporate logos at the ballpark or on the program of our local arts festival. Every patch of empty space and every second of empty time is ripe for conversion into money. I once read that advertisers can buy time on a special radio station that broadcasts commercials into the Lincoln Tunnel for 7 minutes or so of the empty time when cars are out of reach of normal broadcasters. Today, there is even talk of new sound technologies that will deliver location-specific messages to pedestrians as they walk past each store. A variant of social capital might be termed civic capital. Civic capital is the generalized, culturally transmitted participation in politics and government, including both the confidence and the political skills to participate effectively in democratic society. In his book Bowling Alone, political scientist Robert Putnam chronicles a generation-long decline in civic participation that has reduced democratic citizenship to a mere matter of voting, more meaningless choices in a box. Few people these days participate meaningfully in local government, as the community networks that once exercised political clout have evaporated along with other dimensions of community. Increasingly, though recently, there are signs that this trend is reversing. We are content to choose among the options presented us from on high. Finally, we are losing what we might call physiological or health capital, the biological resources and abilities of the human body. It is evident that many of our human capacities have atrophied to be supplemented with technology. For example, not only do most people not know how to procure food and shelter in nature, but many Americans over the age of 50 cannot survive without a variety of pharmaceutical medications. Nor are most women able to give birth to a child in the absence of technology. Soon they may need it to conceive. Infertility is a growing problem worldwide, and recent studies have confirmed an annual decrease of around 2% in sperm counts. The aids and comforts of technology have become props to survival on the biological level. Admittedly, most of the dependence is an illusion, a function of ignorance, In the case of pharmaceuticals, an ignorance of natural medicine and the maintenance of the body. In the case of childbirth, an institutional distrust of the woman's body and a taught fear that compels women to seek expert assistance. While the dependence on technology is not yet total, we are slowly but surely losing our abilities to walk, sleep, squat, sit cross-legged, run, defecate, why else so many laxative commercials on TV, and even to breathe. Technology accomplishes for us the functions these abilities used to serve. In most cases, this dependency has not yet been integrated into our genes and is in principle reversible. Nonetheless, we have indeed sold or at least mortgaged much of our physical health to the demands of the money economy. My health is an asset, a resource that I can convert into money. For example, by working overtime in an office or working in hazardous conditions. Remember the eternal business idea of taking something away from someone and then selling it back to them? Technological society, through its conveniences and demands, has taken away our health and now sells it back to us for money, through the machinations of medicine, supplements, fitness centers, and so forth, all of which allow us to cope in today's world. The semblance of health they bestow is usually enough to get by in a technological society, where we rarely have to endure cold temperatures for a long time, or climb trees, or walk for 10 miles. But it is a far lower level of health than a human living in nature enjoys. If current trends persist, the dependence on medical technology is likely to grow more and more acute. Until we reach the science fiction world where medical devices and other technology are incorporated into the human body from birth or even before. Already there is talk about designer babies whose genes are artificially engineered or selected for specific traits. Already there are implants of computer chips and various time-release drugs. And while the talk is of someday creating superhumans with vastly augmented mental and physical capacities, most of the applications so far are simply to help unhealthy people to cope, to get by. We are experiencing today an epidemic of mysterious new diseases, mostly malfunctions of the immune system. Science is making progress toward a cure, we're told, but another way to look at it is that a perhaps lifelong course of drug therapy, gene therapy, or whatever will effectively incorporate technology into bodies that are not viable without it. Since the diseases of the 21st century are, in the opinion of most alternative practitioners, caused by technology, environmental toxins, sedentary lifestyles, and industrial food processing, to name a few, our use of technological medicine indeed amounts to the buying back of what technology has taken away from us to begin with. In other words, we have converted our physiological or genetic capital into financial capital. We have sold away our health only to buy back an inferior version of it. Earlier I wrote, what else do people still do for themselves? What else could be converted into a service? What about body parts and functions? I am thinking here of the kidney industry, which induces poor people around the world to sell their own kidneys for transplants in the West. Another growth industry is the surrogate womb business, outsourced increasingly to third world countries. From conception to gestation to birth, from nursing to daycare to school, from the Little League to summer camp to electronic entertainment, the process of making a human being becomes, in the extreme, a series of services. Not too far, really, from the nightmares of Aldous Huxley. When we become aware of the magnitude of our destitution, we naturally desire to reclaim for ourselves some of that lost wealth. However, to reclaim our lost health and connectedness, stories and imagination, capacities and relationships is no trivial matter. Many of the old relationship-sustaining structures are broken, leaving us alone and helpless. We know not where to begin. Moreover, the monetization of life engenders a relentless insecurity and anxiety that bludgeons us into submission. When all our survival skills have been sold off, we are left dependent on money, a supreme irony, given that people sacrifice life for money precisely for the stated purpose of achieving financial security. Money, once incidental to survival, as in the case of the subsistence farmer, now becomes synonymous with the means to survive. A natural corollary of the conversion of the physical, social, and cultural world to property is that we must pay to live. Could this, and not a sinful human nature, be the reason for the anxiety and greed that so pervades our culture? Dependency on money, coupled with the ceaselessly intensifying competition it implies, means that it is not only difficult but also irrational to reclaim life for ourselves. The remote specialists and professionals who discharge our life functions do so much more efficiently than we can. To cook from scratch, garden, fix our own cars, play our own music, and make our own clothes are economically inefficient activities that set us back in life's great competition. In economics, the very word rational means the maximization of one's financial interests, a very significant assumption. How much is your time worth? How many dollars per hour? Go ahead and calculate how much money you net by changing your own oil. Include the cost of your own labor. It is more rational to let the specialist do it. It is more rational to let the specialist at the supermarket bakery bake your son's birthday cake. The cake costs only $4, and it would take you more than an hour. It is more rational to let the specialists with their vast economies of scale cook all your food. It is more rational to let dedicated specialists clean your house and take care of your children. Time, after all, is money. The emptiness of this way of thinking is self-evident, for it reduces life to money just as the phrase time is money implies. Yet the reduction of life to money is exactly what is happening through the choices we make or are compelled to make. It is exactly what is happening wherever technology makes our lives more convenient. The reduction of life to money is exactly what is happening through the vast conversion of all forms of social, spiritual, cultural, and natural capital into financial capital. The equation time is money brings us to the heart of the matter. Having turned all the world and everything in it into property, we apply the same equation to time itself, subjecting our every interaction to the calculus of economic justification. In this saying is encoded nothing less than the complete monetization of human life. There is something monstrous about the very idea of a wage, the sale of one's time. That is a sale of one's life. You sell the very hours of your life. Such a concept indeed sparked tremendous resistance during the early Industrial Revolution, before which Kirkpatrick Sale writes, "Time was a medium, not a commodity." But as the routine mechanical actions of the assembly line worker and industrial machine operator replaced the skills of the independent craftsperson, skills became increasingly superfluous until workers had naught to offer but their time. They resisted heroically this monetization of life itself, even when the alternative was utter destitution, and the question of how to instill and enforce labor discipline became a leading topic among intellectuals of the day. Unfortunately, self-evident as its emptiness may be, the reduction of life to money is written on a deep level into the assumptions of economics and the criteria for public policy. Its main conceptual justification originated in the philosophy of Jeremy Bentham, who thought that the duty of government should be to maximize total happiness. True to the Galilean tradition, he decided that the way to proceed would be to quantify goodness, or as he thought of it, utility. Then it would be a simple matter to calculate the total utility resulting from policy A, compare it to the total for policy C, and choose the one generating the most utils of happiness. Now you'd think that to quantify happiness or goodness is a notion so absurd as to require no comment. I wish that were true. In fact, we have actually attempted to implement Bentham's suggestion, though in a disguised form. Instead of the util, we denominate the good in dollars. Economics asserts that we are rational actors, economic man, seeking to maximize a self-interest, personal good measured in dollars. The good of the nation, too, finds expression in dollars whenever we assume that economic growth is a positive good. Economic growth is defined in terms of gross domestic product, the total value of all goods and services measured in dollars. Another significant quantification of goodness is embodied in cost-benefit analysis, which assumes that all relevant costs and benefits can be assigned a monetary value. In so doing, it is often necessary to assign a value even to human life. Is it worth it to spend $1 billion on safety equipment that will save 10 lives? How much money is a human life worth? How much is your life worth? The monstrous implications of this way of thinking, a literal reduction of life to money, are clear. Ethicists tie themselves into knots over this issue. But no satisfactory solution is possible as long as we continue to quantify the good. Yet some economists seem to think that this quantification has not gone far enough. Exemplified by Gary Becker, they proclaim that an economic calculus governs all human interactions, from crime to marriage to the pursuit of education. Becker, who won the Nobel Prize for having extended the domain of microeconomic analysis to a wide range of human behavior and interaction, including non-market behavior, advocates extending market mechanisms into these remaining non-market realms. Ah, if only the monetization of life could be completed, then life would be perfectly rational, perfectly efficient. The use of the word goods to denote the saleable products of human activity reveals some very deep assumptions. First, harking back to agriculture, it suggests that goodness comes from human manipulation of nature and not from nature itself. A good is something produced, extracted from its original place in the ground, the water, or the forest, and then subjected to other forms of processing. Unimproved nature is not good. Oil in the ground or a forest left standing are invisible to economic accounting. They are not yet goods. Just as unpaid mothering is not yet a service. A second implication is that if something is good, it can be assigned a price. Commoditized, bought and sold. Got that? Our definition of a good is that it can be exchanged for money. Money equals good. That some things are not yet commodities merely means that the conversion of social, cultural, spiritual, and natural capital is not yet complete. Good news for anyone but an economist. From the economist's point of view, the equation of economic growth with more and more goods adds a note of moral imperative to the quest for economic growth. More and more goodness, more and more happiness, the ascent of humanity. To cry enough or to call a limit was treason. Happiness and expanding production were one. And I've been reading from Charles Eisenstein's The Ascent of Humanity. The age of separation, the age of reunion, and the convergence of crises that is birthing the transition. I've been reading from Chapter 4, Money and Property. And I think you can see why I opened the show by calling this the age of prostitution. I'll continue next week, but you don't have to wait. You can read Charles' entire book online at www.ascentofhumanity.com. And you can download this and all previous episodes of the show at unwelcomeguests.org. And I encourage you to download these things and pass them around to others. Spread the word. That's the only way we're going to change things. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you so much for listening.